As the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you these things so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. This is my command, love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. I do not call you servants anymore, because a servant doesn't know what his master is doing. I have called you friends because I have made known to you everything I have heard from my Father. You did not choose me, but I chose you. I appointed you to go and produce fruit, and that your fruit should remain, so that whatever you ask in the Father, ask the Father in my name, he will give you. This is what I command you, love one another.
Hi, good morning. I'm very excited to be with you today. I was telling Pastor Todd that this is the first time I have been in in-person church in over a year. And so my goal for the day was just to not start crying and not be able to stop. So far, so good. So if you read the introduction of me that your pastor emailed you, you found out that I like stories. So I am going to be telling you some stories today because, well, you can't stop me. So, I am standing here today because I made a joke on Twitter about how Mother's Day at church makes me very uncomfortable, because it does. Partially because I am super introverted, as you can tell, as I stand here and talk to a room full of people. This is much more comfortable to me than like small talk with two or three people. That's like, it makes me like physically shake. So I'm very, very introverted. So mandatory social interaction makes me very nervous, and like expected affection makes me very nervous. And so Mother's Day is very awkward to me. Like, if people in church will tell me Happy Mother's Day, I'm like, I'm not your mom. I don't know what to say. Like, it's uncomfortable to me. And part of it is my awkwardness. The other part of it, though, is that really sometimes we struggle as a church to make what is supposed to be central to our faith central to our faith, and instead we make ourselves and our families central to our churches. And so sometimes in church we talk about family and the importance of family almost more like we're Mormon than like we're Jesus, than like we're Jesus followers, right? And so we say the most important thing is family, and if we look at scripture, family is important to God and it is good and God ordains it, but it is not the main thing. And so what we build our lives on is not our families. Everybody builds their lives on their families, right? If we go into a Muslim culture, they build their lives around their families. If we go to a secular culture, they build their lives around their families. If we go to the Far East, they build their lives around their families. And so we, a lot of the time, are reflecting our culture more than shaping it into a cruciform family that doesn't just look like ourselves, but that looks like the larger family of God that we're supposed to be inviting everyone into a better way. And so that's part of why Mother's Day makes me kind of uncomfortable, because I think we kind of put our families up on a little pedestal. And this, first of all, statistically, in this room, there are going to be people who have broken relationships with their family, people who are single, people who are struggling with infertility or child loss. And so we exclude all of these people trying to lift up mothers sometimes. And instead of saying mothers are good and fathers are good and families are good because they're a reflection of our Father, but they're one piece of it. And the family of God is so much bigger and more beautiful and multifaceted than that. And so instead of building our church around our families, we need to find a new starting place. And then we build our families on top of that within the church, right? Sam Albury, I don't know if you know who he is. I like him a lot because he's British, and so everything he says sounds smart. So just pretend this is a British accent and it'll sound really smart. In his book on singleness, he says, "We've made the nuclear family the basic unit of church life so that if you are unmarried or don't have a family, you don't know where you fit in. We've built churches around nuclear families and try to fit everyone else in, and we've had the wrong starting point. If we are trying to fit in people to the church this way, we've definitionally started by excluding them. We need to find a new starting point." To put another way, because our families are good and important, sometimes we try to make good things best things and important things most important things, but our families are going to end up being sinking sand if it is what we build our lives on. I have a great family, but it is not the solid rock of Jesus that is never shaken. And so we want to build our church and build our lives on this picture of we are building a house on Jesus, and then our families are one wall of that house, but they are not the whole house, right? And so instead of focusing on the wall, what we need to do to be able to build a life and to build a family and to build a church that is cruciform to Jesus is to examine our starting point. So we're going to look at some starting points, and I'm going to tell you the story of two mothers. One is fictional and one is true. So there's a few books that I go back to again and again and again and again, read them every year, sometimes multiple times a year. The Chronicles of Narnia, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. I'm super cool, as you can tell. But another one is the Anne of Green Gables series by Lucy Maud Montgomery. I really wanted to live in like Nova Scotia or Prince Edward Island for a while as a kid until I realized how cold it was there. And then I found out that poplar trees are just another name for cottonwoods, and I was like, I've been lied to about this idyllic thing in my brain. And so, but I'm going to tell you the story of Anne. And if you, do you guys know Anne Shirley? Yes? Okay, if you've seen the Netflix series, that doesn't count. Okay, that's okay, because I'm going to tell you the story. So Anne is an orphan. She's unwanted. She's unloved. And according to the culture that she's in, she's also unlovely. And she has spent her entire life, up until she's 11 years old, being basically utilized by adults but never cared for by them. And so she goes from home to home to home caring for other people's children but never being cared for herself until there's a miscommunication and an accident, and she ends up at the home of Marilla and Matthew Cuthbert in Avonlea on Prince Edward Island. Now, Matthew is an old bachelor. He is very shy. He is very kind and generous, but like will hide behind a pole to not have to talk to you, right? Marilla is very frank and brusque. She kind of missed her chance at having a husband and a family, and she just takes care of Matthew and their farm, right? Matthew's getting older. He needs help on the farm. They decide that they're going to adopt a little boy to raise and to take over the farm, and instead they get an 11-year-old skinny, freckled, redheaded girl who can't stop talking named Anne. And what happens is Anne is placed accidentally, or as Marilla will later say, by providence, into a place where she blossoms and grows because she's tended to on this farm in Green Gables. So I'm going to talk to you about the many mothers of Anne. You have Marilla, of course, but then you also have her teacher, Miss Stacy, who is also unmarried and childless and sees this potential in Anne and nurtures it and grows it until she goes and gets much more education and accolades and career than is normal for a woman of her time and place. You also have Mrs. Allen, her Sunday school teacher, who doesn't shy away or rebuke Anne for her questions and her doubts, but nurtures her curiosity and helps to instill in her a deep love of God and the things of God. You have Mrs. Josephine Berry, who isn't even in the same town, and because she cares about Anne and is invested in Anne, she leaves Anne part of her fortune that allows her to go to school and provides for her family. You have Aunt Jasmina, who is the older aunt of one of her schoolmates who lives in their house with them and allows them to get their education. And then you have Miss Cornelia Bryant. When Anne grows up and gets married and moves away to start her own family, Miss Cornelia mirrors Marilla in that she is not just a mother to Anne as an older unmarried woman, but she's a mother to the entire island community that they live in. In fact, when Anne meets Miss Cornelia, she's sewing onesies for a poor family in town. And so all through Anne's life, she has all of these mothers, and they're almost all unmarried and all childless. But the ripple effect of their mothering Anne spreads out, and we actually see it in the titles of the book, Anne of Green Gables, Anne of Avonlea, Anne of the Island. And this ripple effect of the mothers of Anne is having an impact not just on her life, but on the lives of her children and her friends and everyone who she has contact with, right? So here's Marilla, who is an older unmarried woman on a family farm with no heirs, and she gets a little girl who is not going to be the thing that passes on the legacy that she thinks that she wants, right? And what happens is, through her devotion to God and her commitment to righteousness, which means goodness to everyone who comes in contact with her, she allows Anne to be planted like the white-blossomed tree outside of her window. And this little girl who has only known caring for and never known care blossoms. And it branches out all through the community and all through the island and all through the area. And that doesn't stop with Anne. In fact, later Marilla takes in a widow who can't afford to live in her house anymore. And then she takes in twins when she's like 15 years older, when she's already older, when she adopts Anne, and raises them. And so her legacy is not in her barrenness, and it's not in her not fitting in to what's expected in her culture to get married and have kids and pass on the family farm. Her legacy is this bearing of fruit that branches out in her care and devotion to other people, right? So she is a mother born not out of her body, but out of vocation and conviction that God has appointed her in a place to do what is right for everyone who comes in contact with her in that place. And that blossoms this brusque, frank woman who is kind of stiff and stern into a mother. So if we look at John 15, and I'm going to start in verse 1 because I like context, and it says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener, and every branch in me that does not produce fruit, he removes, and he prunes every branch, and that which produces fruit will produce more fruit. You're already clean because of the word I've spoken to you. Remain in me, and I in you. Just as a branch is unable to produce fruit by itself unless it remains on the vine, neither can you unless you remain in me. So here's what happens in the story of Anne. She is planted in a place where she can grow. And then the fruitfulness of Marilla's faithfulness is realized in her blossoming. And so the first thing that we need to focus on if we're going to build a life and build families and build church that are cruciform to Jesus is we need to realize that it is the true vine that produces fruit, not us. In Psalm 80, Israel is pictured as a cutting that's taken out of Egypt and planted into the promised land. And then later we're told that we are grafted into that vine, right? Like Pastor Todd was talking about with the children, that we branch out and we grow and we produce fruit because we remain in Jesus. We dwell in him, right? We become of him like Anne becomes of Green Gables. And so it is a place where we dwell, and then we bear fruit. And so our legacy, the pressure is taken off of our family tree, right? The pressure is taken off of our interpersonal relationships, and it's all put on Jesus. And so Jesus grows as we are grafted and tended into him, bearing the fruit from his body, so that our legacy doesn't look like us, it looks like him, as it branches out and blossoms and bears fruit, and the ripples spread beyond us. And so we don't multiply ourselves like Adam and Eve do, but we multiply his likeness. Born in his body, his birth, his death, and his resurrection that gives new life. Second story. Two other stories that I would read a lot growing up were Chariots of Fire. I would read it at the beginning of every track season, not because I was fast, not because I was going to be fast, but I knew that I could be faithful. And I knew that I could examine my own self and use the things that I have, not fastness, for God's glory like Eric Liddell did. And so I read that every year. And another thing that I read every year was either In My Father's House or The Hiding Place, which is the stories of Corrie Ten Boom. If you don't know who Corrie Ten Boom is, that's okay. I'm going to tell you. You can't stop me. Corrie Ten Boom was Dutch Reformed. She grew up in a clock and watch repair maker's shop. Their house was called the Beige, and it was sort of the hub of their community. And then later, during the Nazi occupation, it became one of the hubs of the Dutch resistance in Harlem. Corrie Ten Boom's entire living family at the time of the Nazis was captured by the Nazis and sent to concentration camps. She and her sister Betsy were sent to Ravensbrück. She survived. She's the only one of her family to survive. I think. Maybe a brother survived. Don't look that up later. So she wrote a book called The Hiding Place. And one of the things that she says in The Hiding Place is that she's kind of wrestling with this. She knows that what the Nazis are doing is wrong, but she's sort of wrestling with her personal morality of, is it okay to lie? Is it okay to hide? Is it okay to do these things? And so in wrestling with that, she says at one point in the book, love, how does one show it? How could God himself show truth and love at a time like this? By dying. And that's the story of Corrie Ten Boom. She also kind of doesn't fit in to the things that she's supposed to fit into. She comes from a very big family. She doesn't get married. Her sister Betsy doesn't get married. They are living with their father in their 50s as they're hiding people in their house from the Nazis as part of the underground to protect and try to evacuate Jewish families. And so she doesn't have a family except for the family that she's born into. But she is mother to all of these children who are in much more desperate circumstances than Anne. And not just children, but men and women, including in her church and in the resistance, but then also these Jewish people who are supposed to be outside of their community, right? And so she becomes a mother to all of these people, and she gives them care in an hour that is super desperate, right? And even ends up giving up basically her whole life for people that she's not related to, that she doesn't know, that aren't a part of her who we belong to. Why does she do that? Because she grows up in the house of Casper Ten Boom, a father who for decades before the Nazis get to Holland has shaped his family through demonstrating sacrificial love to everyone he comes in contact with. Their table, long before it had Jewish and resistance people hiding at it, had been full of people that he would bring in from the streets to feed and to house and to clothe. And so as we look at the next part of our passage here, it says, as the Father loved me, I've loved you, remain in my love. If you keep my commands, then you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands. And so John is telling us that when we are planted in Jesus and we start to grow and branch out, then what's going to happen is the love of the Father is going to come out through us, right? And so as Corrie Ten Boom and Betsy Ten Boom and her siblings grew up in a house with a father who loved sacrificially, then that family eventually gives up everything, comfort, food, money, freedom, their future, even their lives, because they watch their mother and father do it, and they know this is who we are. This is what our family is for. Our family is not for the sake of propagating ourselves. It is for the sake of providing love and care to others, even at the cost of our own lives. And John repeats this theme over and over again in his writing, right? In fact, in 1 John, and towards the end of his life, when he's writing to the church and calling them his little children because he's a father to them now, he says, "This is how you know that you belong to the Father, that you give up your life for your brother, and not your brother who's related to you." So mothers and fathers in the families and in the church who love like the Father beyond our own families, like Corrie Ten Boom says when she's describing how in Ravensbrück, when she and Betsy become mothers to the barracks in Ravensbrück, and she's talking about why she does that, she says, because love is larger than the walls that shut it in. And we are so tempted to build our little homes into castles where we put up barracks and barricades and we protect ourselves. And a family that is formed in the love of the sacrificial Father, it has a house with open doors. When we lived in Albuquerque, our front door had a passcode, and which was amazing. Like, I didn't carry house keys for years. Sometimes I would leave the house without my car keys because I would forget that I needed keys. But we would give it to people. We would say, "Hey, this is the code." And the rule was, like, if I've given you the code, the door is open to you. And growing up, my house was the house that people just came to, right? I remember one time someone came and rang the doorbell and came in the front door, and we were all like, "What are you doing? Do you not know how to come in the garage? Like, be normal." And so I've always lived in a house where the doors were open, right? And in the same way, a house that is grounded in the Father's sacrificial love and planted in Jesus, it has doors wide open. Does that mean that you don't lock them at night and you don't show wisdom and discernment? No. But it means that our houses are not our castles where we're building little fiefdoms to ourselves, but they are outposts of the kingdom of God, where we are setting up we're setting up ambassadorships, right? And we're throwing the doors open and saying, "You come in. You belong here." My best friend is married to one of my friends from high school also. And they live just kind of down the street from us. And since we've been home, since last year, one of the only places I've gone has been their house. And if their big door is open and not locked, I just walk in. Like, if they know I'm coming or not. And, like, so sometimes they'll just come out of the back and I'm hanging out in the kitchen, like, making myself a snack. And the same way that I would do in my sister's house, right? Because I know that I am welcome there and belong there no matter what is happening. That is my place, in the same way that my own house is, because we belong to each other. And so our doors are wide open to each other. Rosaria Butterfield in The Gospel Comes with a House Key, when she says, our homes are not our castles. Indeed, they are not even ours. And so if we are going to build a life and build families and build a church that are cruciform to Jesus, we have doors that are flung wide open. What does that look like? That may look like being the house that feeds kids. That may look like being the dad that gets called to go pick up kids when they get in trouble and take them home because they're scared to go home. That may look like being the mom who doesn't have her own children, but everybody calls her aunt, or everybody talks about how she loved them when they were little. That may look like opening our houses to foster care or adoption. It may look like deep friendship where people know that they have the code and the door is open to them. That may look like giving help and hospitality to the refugee or to the single mother. It may look like advocacy for our school children like your pastor does. But what it always, always looks like is welcome to people who are not us. In Psalm 68, well, let me turn real quick. In Psalm 68, the psalmist says that God in his holy dwelling is father to the fatherless, the champion for widows, that he sets the lonely in families and leads out the prisoners into prosperity. So if we, as the family of God, are going to look like the family of God, then like Corrie ten Boom looked like her father, we're going to look like our father. And what our father does is he is the defender of the widows. And in putting that in our context, that could actually look like anyone who is single and unmarried. It could look like a single mom. It could look like someone who has never been married. It could look like someone who's been divorced. And so to look like our father as mothers and fathers in the church, then we are the defender of the one who is not part of that nuclear family structure. He's the father to the orphan. He sets the lonely in families. If we look at that in the Hebrew, another way to say that is that he gives a place to the isolated inside a home. And then he brings out the prisoner to prosperity, but leaves the rebellious in the dry and desolate land. To have a church, to have a family, to have a life that is built not on this starting point of something that may be good, but is not the main thing, but to have a life and a family and a church that is built on the solid rock that will not be shaken means to be planted into Jesus. Jesus invites every one of us into the promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob's descendants that no matter our family of origin, that promise belongs to us, that he will be our God and we will be his people, and that he will redeem and restore and welcome us, that we will be grafted into the true vine that always bears fruit no matter our circumstances. Jesus fulfills and transforms the promise to Eve that not by the pain of birth in her body, but by the broken body of Christ, that Jesus invites us to be born into this family, a family born in his blood and the power of his spirit that always brings new life. And Jesus calls us into the household of the Father, freeing us from having to deal with building our own kingdoms, because those are always going to fall. And so it frees us to open our hearts and our homes in love to all, because that is what our Father does. And as mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters within the household of God, that is what he do, because we live in his house. And so our affections are freely given and received, and we freely belong and bring in, and we hold loosely the families that we make, not because they're not good, or sometimes because they're not good, but because that we know that the family that God promises us, that he wants to fold our families into, along with every other kind of family, is a family that is never broken, it is never unfruitful, and never has closed doors. And so we cling tightly to that while we hold loosely. We cling tightly to being spiritual mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters in the church, including inside our own houses. And we know that God takes every good thing and every broken thing, and he bears it in his body, giving new life, calling us home to the Father who has called us beloved sons and daughters and is making it so.